Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Today for Spirit in Action, we'll travel over three continents in search of international understanding, connection, and peace. Our guest is Daniel Mama, and he is the author of As the Rivers Merge, A Story of Love, War, and Perseverance Across Continents. Daniel and his siblings were raised between their mother's Hungary and their father's Nigeria and in a couple other countries, with all the intricacies of attitudes, culture, and history that result in the face of major differences. Daniel's ability to see and share the nuances and complexities draws on his lived experience and is enhanced by his experience as a professor of psychiatry. Before we dive into our visit with Daniel, I want to suggest that you visit the NorthernSpiritRadio.org website for several reasons. On the site, you'll have the opportunity to make our communication two-way, including giving us your feedback and your suggestions of topics and guests we should be including. You can check out our 35-plus stations nationwide who carry our shows, and maybe you can help us add your local station to our list. And of particular importance at the moment is your donation to make Northern Spirit Radio sustainable. It appears that an extra lot of donations have been going to things like the impending elections, and that means that our coffers are bone dry without funds for even the coming month. So please donate to Northern Spirit Radio if you can, and also keep helping your local community radio station, and please help assure a flourishing democracy in the U.S. This is asking a lot, but when we work together, we can perform miracles. And as we move to today's guest, Daniel Mama, maybe we can glean some insights and wisdom to help our nation and the world fruitfully forward. Daniel joins us via Zoom from St. Louis, Missouri. Thanks so much for joining me for Spirit in Action.
Thank you for inviting me.
One thing I have to clear up before we get going, I finished reading the book yesterday, As the Rivers Merge, and there is no Daniel Mama in the book. And so I think that you must be one of the other sons. What was your name growing up?
Well, Tonya is my Nigerian name, and that is the name that relatives call me. So my parents, my siblings all call me Tonya, as well as my extended family in Hungary and Nigeria. Everyone calls me Tonya. However, outside of my family, in school, at work, I go by Daniel. So there was this dichotomy growing up.
What age did you start? Right when you started going to school, you were David?
No, I was Daniel right from, my first name is Daniel.
Okay.
So my first name is Daniel, but for whatever reason, since I was a baby, I was called Tonya by family members, and it just stuck.
Where I lived in southern part of Togo, where the larger tribal group is Ewe, they would, of course, called me Kofi because I was born on Friday. Do they have names like that in Nigeria amongst your tribal, one that's dependent on the day you're born?
Yes. In fact, it's very interesting because in Nigeria, there is an English name like Friday. So there are people who go by the English word Friday, and that is their name, right? And so names like Friday, Sunday, Monday are quite common. So that's very interesting.
So you've lived in more places than most people have. Certainly Hungary, where your mother is from. There was the time in England where your father was pursuing his studies, getting a further degree. There's Nigeria. And did you live in multiple places in Nigeria?
No, I mainly lived in the south in a place called Port Harcourt.
And then right now you're in St. Louis. Have you lived other places around the U.S.? I know that your sister went to school in Kansas, right?
Yes.
And where's she?
Now she's in Houston. She used to live somewhere else. She was in Kansas initially, then she went to Seattle, and now she's in Houston.
So you got people sprinkled all over. Your youngest sisters, where are they, the twins?
Well, one of them is here in the United States. She lives in Atlanta, and then I have one. The other twin is in Hungary.
So which languages are you fluent in? Obviously English, Hungarian?
And Hungarian, yes. Just those two.
Come on, there must be two or three other languages. One of the things I was amazed by for the 2 years that I lived in Togo when I was in the Peace Corps is people there were used to speaking a minimum of two, three, four languages. In Togo, at the time when I was there, the official language was French because it had been a French colony. The schools were all in French. That's what I taught in. But there were also three national languages to bring the different tribes together. Did they have anything like that in Nigeria?
Yeah, so in Nigeria, the national language is English. So everybody around the country speaks English. In school, the education is, the curriculum is in English. So everyone speaks that, some more fluently than others, but everybody speaks to some degree. And then depending on where you grew up, you may also learn other languages. Right. So the reason I don't speak any tribal languages is because I lived in a big city called Port Harcourt, and almost nobody spoke a tribal language within the city. So everyone spoke English. Now, not every city is that way. There are some larger cities where they do speak tribal languages on an everyday basis, but Port Harcourt just happened to be a place where English was really the only language spoken. My dad, however, grew up in a more rural area in the south, and he spoke three different tribal languages in addition to English. And of course, then he later on learned Hungarian. So he was fluent in multiple languages.
This was in the Rivers area. I don't know enough of Nigeria. I never traveled there. I was in Togo for the 2 years. I was in Ghana a few times. I was in Ivory Coast or Cote d'Ivoire. I was in what used to be called Upper Volta, Burkina Faso now. I've been to Mali. I've been to Senegal. But I haven't been to Nigeria. And the main reason was because at the point I was there, it was not easy to travel across Benin because they had their revolutionary government and it was problematic. So I never got to get over there. What did I miss?
Well, Nigeria is a very unique country in Africa. The country is the largest, population-wise, the largest country in Africa. I think we have about 250 million people that live there. And the country is a fraction of the size of the United States. And so the population density of Nigeria is very high. And it's a multi-tribal country, like many African countries are. There are multiple different tribes and languages, over 250. But everyone speaks English, which is the national language. And so in schools and in workplaces, English is what is used. And then I was also saying that the country in general is a wealthy country because they have a lot of money that comes from oil. Nigeria is one of the largest producers of oil around the world. Definitely in Africa, it is the largest producer of oil. However, the people do live, there are a lot of people that live in poverty in the country. And so there's still a lot to be done in terms of developing the country, but it has made some progress over the years.
Togo, in comparison, they said that there were 40 languages and dialects spoke there. And so they were able to do that thing where they said there were three national languages. So everybody in school would learn Ewe, Kabye, and Kotokoli. And so they were conversant at least a little bit with the other languages. I imagine it's not like that. Have you traveled much of Nigeria?
Yeah, I've been to several cities and several parts of the country. And they're all very different and very unique in their own ways. And different languages are spoken in different places.
Very early in the book, your dad deals with the fact that, I don't know what, I think in the U.S. we called it the Biafran War. Around 1969, I think, 68. I was pretty young at that point, so I wasn't really following international news. But that impacted your father as well.
Yes. So between 1967 and 70, I believe. And it was one of the most difficult times in Nigeria's history. This was a time where a section of the country, a region of the country, wanted to break away from Nigeria in general. And of course, the Nigerian government opposed this, and it led to a really brutal and deadly war where a lot of people passed away and endured lifelong trauma. And what was so unfortunate about this chapter in our history is it followed a really optimistic period of Nigeria's history. In 1960, Nigeria gained independence from Great Britain. And so there was a lot of jubilation and a lot of optimism that the country is now independent, they get to rule themselves. But over the years, there were lots of political struggles, lots of military coups and assassinations of leaders, and it culminated in this really deadly civil war.
And that was at the time that your father was trying to go to school at various places and have to sneak through the lines of essentially the tensions between all the different tribes.
Right, exactly. I mean, it was a really difficult time for him because he was still a teenager when the Civil War broke out. And he was in his later period of high school. And he had these great ambitions. He wanted to go to university. He wanted to go to college. You know, he had grand goals for himself. And he had to stop school because the Civil War had advanced so much. And that was a major part of the book, is what can he do? Because he has to stop school. And it was really dangerous for him to just go to school in general. And so he had to retreat and go back to his village to try to figure out what he's going to do next.
Could you divvy up for our Spirit in Action listeners how long you lived in the various places you've lived in your life? Hungary, England, Nigeria, and in the U.S. How has your life been apportioned?
I've done this calculation before, and I spent about 11 to 12 years in Nigeria and about 11 to 12 years in Hungary. So it's almost exactly even, but it's sort of broken down in different phases of my life. So about 11, 12 years in Nigeria, Hungary, and I spent, I want to say, 2.5 years in the UK when I was really young. And then in my later life, after graduating from medical school, I came to the US. And so I ended up spending, I came to the US in 99 and I've been here since. So this year would make it 25 years in the US.
So you headed to the US just after your parents died?
About 2 years after my parents died. And I really came here after I graduated from school, from medical school.
How many doctors do you now have in your family?
Well, medical doctors, we have three. My twin brother is also a medical doctor, and my younger sister is also a medical doctor. And then I have another sister who has a PhD, who has an AUD in audiology.
Wow, a lot of medicine for the world. Does your sister still go by Ibinimi, or however it's pronounced?
She will always go by Ibinimi within the family, and that's not going to change.
Okay. I imagine in the U.S. it's hard. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's in the same boat that I'm in, where the family used her Nigerian name, or still use her Nigerian name. But outside the family, at work, at school, she also used her English name. So her English name is Catherine.
I would imagine Tonya is easier name, considering that there's people like Kenya, that when you've got that kind of name, it all of a sudden it becomes normal.
Yeah, I mean, Tonya is not an uncommon name in the part of Nigeria that I lived. But other parts of the country, it's not so common.
So the book, As the Rivers Merge, starts with really two traumatic things: the downside of the war in Nigeria and the difficulties that Hungary experienced in the aftermath of World War II. Soviets and Germans and all of the trauma that happened there. What year was your mother born?
My mother was born a year before the end of the World War. So she was born in 1944.
Right. And I think the opening scene, or the scene that I call the opening scene of her life, is in the bomb shelter, or being down in the basement trying to protect yourself from attacks. I think the good news is that you never actually had to live through that.
Yes, that is very fortunate.
And that's in spite of both being in countries that still had trouble in both Nigeria and Hungary. There were uprisings, difficulties there. In the U.S., we get far too complacent because we haven't thought about those things. So we don't really think of that as being danger. That's why the attack on the Twin Towers was so striking to people's core in the U.S. What was parallel for you in terms of traumatic events? I mean, did the attack on the Twin Towers hit you since you were so recently new to the U.S.?
9/11 happened 2 years after I came here. And of course, it resonated with me very emotionally, like with everyone else. And of course, it sort of shapes the way you think about everything else. You're a little bit more cautious about things, and you look at life and realize that it could go any time by factors out of your own control. So that had an effect, but I don't know if it compares to the experiences my parents had, because they were directly threatened by these events that happened to them. So I was fortunate that I was born at a time where there weren't similar kinds of political problems within the country that I lived in. Now, in Nigeria, of course, you know, there were difficult situations. There were lots of military coups where one government would be switched by another. But I wasn't directly in fear of my life during those periods. So I really consider myself, my life, to have been a lot more fortunate than their lives were.
I still think that in some ways, there was a delicate point where your lives and the lives of your parents were balanced. One of the things that I'm aware of is your accent, by the way. You speak English meticulously, wonderfully. That's not a surprise to me. Most Africans are much better at languages than most people in the U.S. because we only grow up with one language. But my opinion is that you do not speak English with an African accent at all. I can detect more your European roots in your accent, because was Hungarian your first language?
Hungarian was my first language, yes.
That's what I would have thought. Your mother would have been most directly. Your father was always so busy learning, achieving, working, always pushing, that I imagine that she was the vocal influence for you.
It's hard to know what shaped my accent. I mean, I lived in Hungary, then I went to England. In fact, I learned English for the first time in the UK. So initially, when I spoke English as a three-year-old, I spoke with a British accent, apparently. And then, of course, I went to Nigeria and I picked up some of that, and then going to Hungary and now the US. So I would think that there's a mix of different things, and people perceive it in different ways. So at least that's the way I interpret how things evolved.
Your skin tint is light. It actually, for me, looks more like Arabic in terms of coloring than most of the people I lived with and lived amongst in Africa. And since your accent is not at base Nigerian or one of the Nigerian tribes, I was wondering if 9/11 was a challenge for you in terms of people who were all of a sudden afraid of Muslims. And you know, there's a number of Muslims, of course, in Nigeria, even though I don't think it's a Muslim majority country.
I don't have that experience. I didn't have that experience after 9/11 with anyone looking at me suspiciously, anything like that. Now, is it possible that some people did and I just wasn't aware? Yeah, that is possible, but I definitely don't have that experience, at least from the American people. That wasn't the case. I mean, people do sometimes think I'm from a variety of countries. I've been told sometimes that I look like I'm from the Middle East, and other people say I look like I'm from South America. And so I've had all kinds of, some people say I look like I'm from North Africa. So again, it's one of those things where people have different opinions about what they think I am.
So I think what is true is that Daniel Mama is a man of the world. He can be anywhere. I guess you don't look Asian. You don't look Southeast Asian at all. That one I would not mistake you for. Part of what I really learned from As the Rivers Merge is how to deal with the bigger world. And I think that's a real problem for people in the United States. As much as the U.S. is my home, and of course, this is where my family is and where a good portion of my friends are, part of what I learned by living in Togo was that in some ways, I'm no longer an American. I'm something more than that. I'm part American for sure, and I've lived here for the vast portion of my life. But no longer can I look at people in other countries and say they're not my brothers and sisters. There's, I think, forces in every country, and this includes Hungary and Nigeria and the UK, where people want to say, no, our country is the one that matters. This is what belongs. This is where I have to give all of my support. Have you experienced that? Have you seen that in all these countries as you tell your family's history in As the Rivers Merge?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's always national pride in every country that you go to. I mean, yeah, Americans are proud of being Americans, and Hungarians generally are proud of being Hungarians, and Nigerians are the same way. And I think that that's okay. But I do think that if you spend time in other countries, you do see the world differently. You do see that the world is so much more than what you experience when you know, if you're just in one place. And that's one of the things that I really feel fortunate about with my upbringing is that I got exposed to all these different cultures and I learned different things from them. I learned some of the positive things in Africa and some of the positive things in Hungary. And I get to incorporate that in the way I think and the way I approach people.
Part of what I observed in Togo, and I don't know that this is still true. It's been more than 30 years since I've again set foot in Togo, although I've been to Kenya, I've been to Rwanda, I've been to the Congo in the years since, multiple times, because there's a lot of Quakers over there, and I'm Quaker. But part of what I think is true is community is stronger in Africa than it is in the U.S. U.S., we're connected with our possessions. In Africa, they're closer to their family. So, for instance, when I was teaching in Togo, the censeur, the vice principal of the school, the lycée I taught at, because he was censeur, which is a big deal, vice principal for the school, he was given this house with multiple rooms, multiple space, three different areas. And so he had three of his cousins were living with him. His brother's wife and brother's child were living with him. All of those people he was supporting in some way, and he's still sending money to his mother. So with all of that in mind, it's really hard to get ahead. Whereas in the United States, it's like, well, I'll take care of myself. They can take care of themselves. Did you experience that in your family? Because again, your mother's from Hungary. Your father's from Nigeria, and you've lived in all these multiple places. How did family versus engagement in the world connection, what our community is outside, how did that go for you?
I happen to come from two families that are really strong and tight-knit. So in Hungary, for example, I have a really large family, and they're all really close. At least when I was growing up, they would all congregate in my grandmom's house. And so we were all really close together. So that there was that feeling of family bonding. And in Nigeria, it was similar. I mean, we had a big family. We were not as close to a lot of people in our family because of where we lived. We lived in the city while a lot of my relatives lived out in the rural area. So we didn't have as much communication with them. But I will say that there was a lot of expectation of what is required by a family member in Nigeria. And so my dad, being really the most accomplished educationally and financially family member, was sort of seen as the person who should support everybody, right? It wasn't even a request. It was, of course, you're supposed to do that. And so he really had to spend a lot of time helping out not just his sisters and his mom and dad, but also extended family members who would see themselves as being closer than they perhaps really are. And so he did spend a lot of his resources to try to help them because that's what the culture expected.
And what about you and your four siblings? Do you carry over that way of thinking or being, most of you in the U.S. right now?
Yeah, I mean, we are also very tight. We've always sort of been tight. Things are a little bit different now that we are all sort of spread out in different parts of the world. But we do try to kind of get together periodically and communicate in other ways. Of course, the situation is a little different than it was for my dad.
A lot different.
I guess a lot different, but we still sort of maintain that bond.
It's quite amazing. There's one scene in the book that you're telling of your mother and father's experiences. There's a couple of them that touch on factors that are so important in terms of how the world ravels or unravels. One is the scene of your mother's already decided she's going to marry your father. And this is a problem because he's black, he's African, and your grandfather is Hungarian and has prejudices which are native to so many people who are not used to others, right? And so your father insists that there has to be this connection. He has to make friends with your grandfather. And your mother is kind of like, well, no, we can just skip that. We can get married, kind of ignore them. And that doesn't talk about that. And does this come down as lore to you? Because obviously it's before you're born.
This sort of highlights the cultural differences, right? So my dad comes from a culture where you have to meet the dad. Like you have to pay your respects to the parents of the person that you want to marry. And so despite the fact that my Hungarian grandfather was opposed to the relationship initially and didn't want to meet him, my dad still wanted to give it a try. He still wanted to go up there and say, hey, look, I'm Matthew Mama, and this is why I want to marry your daughter and whatnot. And, you know, my mom sort of felt like this was going to be a fool's errand, that he's never going to accept him, and wanted to save herself the embarrassment and save my dad from being hurt. And she was ready to get married without his blessing. But my dad insisted that, no, he definitely wants to meet his future father-in-law. So I think it just sort of shows the kind of cultural difference and shows the different mental space that my parents were in.
The racism, the fear of color that is so common throughout Europe and then US and so on, there's no denying it. It's been there and been there horribly at many points. My experience living in my village in Togo flipped things quite a bit, because I was the one white person in my village. And there was a thing that happened. I don't know if there's a comparable thing. I imagine there is, because I experienced it in Ghana and other areas too. When I would walk down the street, there would be kids who had never seen a white person before in my village. Again, you get out of the big cities. In the big cities, it's a very different story. They would stand by the side of the road and they would chant, Yovo, Yovo, bonsoir, ça va bien, merci, Yovo, Yovo. And maybe at first it was a little bit off-putting or cute or something, but then it became, for me, I said, like, look, I'm just living just like other people here. I'm teaching here. And to be treated differently, I didn't want to be. At least I thought I didn't want to be. I don't know if I would have liked to be treated like all Togolese treat each other completely. Was there a similar word to Yovo, which essentially means white person, foreigner? I was told by someone that it actually comes from the Ewe phrase. It's a person who saves us by bringing technology or something like that. I doubted that, but whatever. Was there equivalent in areas in Nigeria?
Yeah, so where I live, they would use the phrase Oyibo, would use for people who are white, right? But interestingly enough, I was also called Oyibo, and my siblings were also called Oyibo because our skin was lighter than the average Nigerian. And so I was sort of used to being called that in school, on the street. Obviously, my mom was called that all the time. And I think there is a, you know, I think a lot of people feel like that's an insult, but I don't think it was meant to be an insult. It's more of a commentary. It's more of something exciting that kids say.
Oh, they were always happy when they were chanting this.
It's not like, you know, the N-word in the, you know, in some country. It's not like that. It's just they're excited to say it, and you know, they don't look down on you. They're saying it. And sometimes they may laugh and giggle. But that doesn't mean that they're looking down on you or they hate you or anything like that. And some people have a hard time making that distinction. So I don't think that that was any negative in any way. I guess the only way it was really negative to be Oyibo in Nigeria was everything was more expensive because they assumed that you had a lot more money.
They tried that with me and they learned it didn't work.
My mom never liked it because she would pay 3-4 times the cost for things that that she should have. And it was really hard for her to go down on the cost. Yeah. So generally, that was our experience there with the word.
Well, they're assuming that she's rich. And there certainly are points where your family had more money than many other families there. But you also describe one period where your mother was losing weight. She had to go without meals because kids had to eat something or milk dried up, etc. So your family was not rich by many standards.
Definitely by U.S. standards, we were poor, right? By Nigerian standards, we were not the poorest because there were people that were so much poorer around us. But we did have periods in our life when we really had very little. And you sort of gave an example a few seconds ago about a time when we didn't have enough to eat because of some problems that my dad had at work where he wasn't getting paid. That was a really difficult time for my mom. She lost a lot of weight and she had health difficulties as a result. It was affecting the children. So we are definitely not rich or wealthy by any standards.
One of the things that I experienced, I talked about the kids calling Yovo. I did have on a couple occasions where I saw where babies who had never seen a white person before are crying. They're afraid of this strange looking person. Also, kids wanting to touch me, including touching my hair, because my hair, which I had at the time, as opposed to what I don't have now, they wanted to touch it because it was so strange that people would have this hair. Did you ever experience that in either Hungary or in the UK or in the US? People, right now, it's considered a negative thing that people want to touch your hair or something like that. And I didn't experience that way, in part because I was privileged. I felt safe.
Right. I mean, I definitely experienced things like that in both countries, in both Hungary and Nigeria, right? So in Hungary, it would be the certain parts of Hungary where seeing a black person was very rare. And of course, in Hungary, I would be seen as a black person. And so I would walk in certain parts of the country and all of a sudden people will stop and look at you. And sometimes they want to come to you and they want to talk to you because it's such... They've never seen anyone that looks like you before. And then similarly in Nigeria, you know, I was seen as Oyibo, right? I was seen as white. I was seen as light skin. And especially when I go to, say, a village or a rural area in Nigeria, everybody stops and just stares at you. Or they're walking with you because they're so intrigued. So I've always found that to be a very endearing thing. I was never really bothered by those experiences.
I think you must have thicker skin than many people. I think you have to have thick skin in order to adapt to all these different areas because they're all filled with challenges.
Yeah, but the thing is, I never saw that to be threatening in any way. It was always very clear to me that they like me. In other words, they don't hate me. When people stop and they stare at you or they giggle or they, you know, I always felt like this person really does find you intriguing and interesting. You can kind of feel that sometimes. And the same thing goes to Hungary when people sort of stop and stare in these rural areas. They're not doing that because they hate you. Now, of course, there are exceptions to that. I've experienced that too. But in general, most of the time when people give you that kind of response, in my experience has been that they are just curious and they're intrigued.
Julie is one of my friends from Peace Corps days. She came in a year after I was there, so I already had a year experience of living in Togo. She's black, and she had a different experience than she expected. She thought, I'm going to go to Africa. She's dark-skinned. She's much darker than you are. She's dark-skinned, so she thought, okay, I'll be with my people. But people called her Yovo, too, and men would try and take advantage of her because they figured she had money as well. So her first few months in Togo were negative for her, very disappointing. And she adjusted eventually and found positive side of it. But did you experience that as well? I mean, it's the downside of not fitting in, not being one identity.
Yeah, I mean, I know that different people have different experiences, so by no means am I saying that my experience is universal. But in general, I would say that in Nigeria, I never really had any kind of significant experiences because I look different. I mean, you know, in school, sometimes people may tease you, they may pinch you and see if you get redder than the average person. And, you know, there are things like that, but, you know, but those are things that kids do in school. In general, I had much more of the positive experience where people, because you're different, they're more curious. Perhaps they want to spend more time with you. They want to talk more with you. So I never had any really bad experiences. And I would say the situation was a little bit different in Hungary. I mean, even in Hungary, I did have largely positive experiences. I remember being in school. I started my grade school in Hungary and I just remember how everyone seemed to always be curious and they always all wanted to talk to me and they all seemed very intrigued. But of course, there were experiences later on in my life, which I also talk about in the book, where I did meet the negative side of Hungary and people who were not as appreciative of people that look different. So I talk about how I had a run-in with skinheads at the time who basically beat me up when I was getting onto a metro train just because they felt like I don't belong in that country, right? So there were those kind of experiences too. But I really believe that overall, the positive experiences outpaced the negative ones.
And folks, today for Spirit in Action, we're speaking with Daniel Mama. He's the author of a new book, As the Rivers Merge, a story of love, war, and perseverance across continents. And I would say it's really a book about aim high, shoot high, too, which was something that Daniel's father grew up with and which seems to pervade his entire drive throughout the book. Is that your motto too?
I believe so. Like my dad, I think it was instilled in me that you always have to be ambitious. You should aim for great things and that you are able to accomplish anything that you set your mind to. The whole aim high and shoot high motto was something that my grandfather used to even tell us as grandkids. I remember him coming over to our house and almost one of the first things that he would say when he comes into the house is, aim high and shoot high, aim high and shoot high. And it explains a lot. It explains why my dad was always motivated to always strive to aim for the sky.
We have Daniel here to talk about the book, As the Rivers Merge, because it is about how we connect and make peace in the world. We have to know our neighbors and accept them as neighbors. So throughout the book, you'll find engagement with Hungary, with British Isles, with Nigeria, and with the U.S., and with a diverse family. It's a rich book of stories that I think once you finish reading through the book, folks, you'll end up knowing more about the world. You'll possess a larger share of the world by being this book. And that's why we have him here today for Spirit in Action. Our website is northernspiritradio.org. On that site, you'll find links to all of our guests of the last 19 years that we've been doing this and my Song of the Soul program. So please check out those links and the other guests. And when you listen to this interview with Daniel, please post a comment on our northernspiritradio.org website. We love two-way communication. We need to hear from you. That's what makes community whole, is two-way communication. So please do that. Also, when you're on our site, you can donate to support Northern Spirit Radio. We survive not by donations from government and not by donations from corporations, but from listeners, because we want to serve your needs. As soon as you accept money from some source, you become tied to some of their objectives. And so we would like you to support us, not turning our favors over to government or corporations. So please do support us, and please support the 35-plus community radio stations across the country who carry this program. Community radio is different than either public radio or corporate radio. You'll find that they can provide a wider breadth of information, knowledge, music to make you even richer. So please support all of those community radio stations. Again, we're speaking with Daniel Mama. And one thing I haven't asked you at all about is religion in your life. Your mother was Catholic, or her family was Catholic, and she had to, because Hungary was a communist country, she had to practice her religion hidden. And if she didn't, she had negative consequences in her opportunities, what schools you can go to, what jobs you can have, all of that hit her. So she carried her faith throughout her life. Your father's father was himself a preacher. And so that was strong current in your father's life as well. And what about you kids?
My parents were very religious, for sure. My dad was an Anglican, a son of an Anglican priest or Episcopal priest. My mom was a devout Catholic. And obviously, if you have parents like that, the children are going to also be raised in a religious way. We mainly attended Catholic church or Catholic mass, but we would also go to Anglican services or Anglican mass sometimes. But my mom would always try to make it a point to make sure that we received all the sacraments from the Catholic Church, and so communion and confirmation and all that, and made sure that we went for confessions regularly. And
did you have a lot to confess?
I think I had moments. I had periods where I went to other periods, for sure.
And has that carried forward in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have two children also, and we go to church every Sunday. My wife is religious also. But I try to not think about myself as religious per se. I try to do the right thing. I don't make no judgments on religion, and people can have different religions, and I think that's okay. I happen to be Catholic, and I'm continuing that at this point. But, you know, I think the important thing that I focus on is to be a good person, to help others, to realize that the world is not just about you. It's about also sacrificing sometimes for others to make other people's lives positive and the world positive.
One of the things I experienced, having spent time in Togo and then coming back to the U.S., was when I re-entered the United States, it's very common for Peace Corps volunteers to feel dislocation, disconnection with the culture we're coming into. We feel like an outsider. And I imagine that you've had to feel that. Where is home to you? Hungary, Nigeria, St. Louis?
It's very interesting. I really feel like I have three homes. That's really as simple as it gets. I don't feel like I have one home. I know sometimes people expect there to just be one, but I really don't feel that way. And part of the reason could be that I spent roughly the same amount of years in Hungary and Nigeria, right? So I don't feel a stronger bond towards one versus the other. And of course, I've spent most of my life now in the US. And so currently, this is where I live. So yeah, so that's what I would say. I would say I really do feel like I have three homes. And when I go to Hungary, I feel like a Hungarian. I don't feel like, oh, I belong somewhere else also. I feel like this is where I belong. And the same thing is what I feel when I go to Nigeria. Is I really feel like I'm one of the people. At that moment, I feel like I belong there. But then I come back and things kind of recalibrate again in my head.
Do you find yourself changing personality between the different cultures when you're there? I mean, there's a physical way. In West Africa, my experience is men touch more than they do in the United States. Men hold hands, and not as a sexual thing, but that's what men can do.
I've been told that before, that my personality changes a little bit when I'm around Nigerians versus when I'm around Hungarians and Americans. So perhaps there is something there. I do know that the way I speak changes when I'm around different people. All right. So I'm speaking to an American right now. This is how I'm speaking. I have a certain cadence about me. If I went to Nigeria, I probably would sound different. My accent would get more African, right? Maybe even in a way where you might find it hard to understand what I'm saying. And then, of course, when I go to Hungary, I switch to Hungarian. So with that, perhaps there are some personality changes that come when you sort of switch your accent or your language. But that's really been the most notable thing that I've perceived, is that the way I talk completely changes.
One of the things that was very jarring for me going to Togo, and I think it was for most Peace Corps volunteers, there are two things. One is the number of beggars, and number two, the corruption that is just accepted, the people wanting bribes for doing their job. And I'm not talking about a tip. I'm talking about you're not moving from this place until you give me some money. Having grown up in the United States without those things, I don't know if I was sheltered, or I don't know if I was privileged. There's a difference in tone between those. How do you think about those things?
That's definitely something I've observed also in Nigeria, especially, that there are a lot of poor people, and there are a lot of poor people in the country. There are going to be a lot of beggars, a lot of people on the streets. And with a lot of poverty comes a lot of corruption. People do whatever they can to get money because it's hard to come by. So unfortunately, that's something that is quite pervasive. At least when I grew up, that was the case. And it was one of the things that my dad really tried to fight against. He really tried to change the system, because he didn't like the way politics was at the time, the way there was so much corruption in the country. But unfortunately, it still exists. I know that there is corruption in many different countries, in different forms. But again, I think the poverty does make a difference. A country that is poor, that doesn't provide for its people, or at least the people don't get enough, has a lot of consequences that come with it.
One part of our culture, and part of related to corruption, that I've thought about is nepotism. In the United States, you're not supposed to give jobs based on connections. You're supposed to give them based on people's abilities, right? You want a high quality person working this job. There's always a factor of nepotism. In Africa, my experience was that it was absolutely expected. You're supposed to give the job to your friends and family. And from the US point of view, oh, that's horrible corruption. And yet when we do it, when I try and help my kid get a job at this place because I have connections, I'm just being a good guy. And so we label it negative in a different country. And in the US, we consider it something of a virtue, you know, because I went to this college, my kid can get in.
Yeah, I mean, I think nepotism is present everywhere in the world. I mean, I definitely see it a lot in the US also. You sort of give a couple of examples. If you went to a really good school, Harvard, Yale, and your child has a much better chance of getting in because you're an alumni. And the same thing goes to job opportunities. It's not unusual, even in the US, for people to connect their kids into good jobs, right? And so sometimes even to work for them. So they, you know, people get around that. I'm not sure what the solution there is, or I'm not even saying it's bad in every case, but it does, I think, occur in many different parts of the world. Definitely, it's something that happens in the countries I grew up in, whether it's Nigeria or Hungary. One could argue that maybe it feels a little bit different, but I think the general principle is very similar.
Would you say today that corruption, that this understanding of what we have to be a democracy, is stronger or weaker in Nigeria than back when you were living there?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think it's still present. I think that in recent years, there have been demonstrations where people would stand up and protest against corruption, bad politics, and things like that, which I don't think used to exist, or at least not to the same degree when I was growing up. So perhaps from that standpoint, things are better, that people are speaking out. People have more ways to protest. You know, we have social media now, people can communicate by X or Facebook or whatnot. So I think from that standpoint, things are better, or at least there are more opportunities for things to change. But I'm not sure within the country itself, I'm not sure if things have gotten much better over the years.
Can you say anything about the situation in Hungary?
Well, I don't follow the politics of Hungary as closely. I know that there are some that have complained about the corruption within politics in Hungary also. I'm sure it exists everywhere. You know, I'm sure the governments and the system are not perfect. So I'm pretty sure it exists there. I think it exists in the United States also. I think the question is, do people have a means to call people out for doing things that they shouldn't be doing? And I think some countries are better at allowing that. And some places make it really hard for you to speak out. It definitely was the case when I was growing up in Nigeria. It was really hard to speak out. You could even lose your life if you spoke out against the government. Things are a little bit better now. And I think in the West in general, it's easier to complain, to call people out for what you perceive as being negative. So that's a good thing.
You've been in the U.S. now for 25 years. Are we getting better or worse? Are we improving or that? And I say this in part because I have my own perspective, having lived internationally, having friends in all these different countries. So I think my perspective is a little bit less tied to the U.S. has to appear a certain way.
I think that corruption and problems within the government and the system have always been there. I mean, as long as you have human beings, you're going to have some people, you're going to have bad apples that don't do things the right way. I think the difference in more recent years is that we are just more aware of what people do, right? Now we can put a microscope onto people because we are on our phones all the time. We are on our devices. We get access to news and we're able to cross-communicate and talk to each other about problems. So that's more what I've noticed is now if somebody does something, the next second, everybody around the world knows about it because it gets tweeted out, it gets posted somewhere. So I think we think about our world as being worse now for that reason than we did 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Because your book, As the Rivers Merge, A Story of Love, War, and Perseverance Across Continents, in this, you're talking about places where democracy, government control, corruption, there's waves of them. There's problems. So because of having learned those stories and seen them as an observer, an involved observer, here's a tough question. Let me just disarm it perhaps by telling you my perspective. I think the U.S. is closer now to losing democracy than we've been as far as I've been alive, and that's 70 years. Do you see anything from your experience in Nigeria or Hungary that tells you that we're at an important inflection point?
So right now, when I look at the world, I see a lot of wars. I see a lot of really devastating, dangerous wars on multiple fronts. And of course, when I was writing this book, I did see a lot of parallels. I did really see how countries could very easily ignite a war that could lead to a more global sort of phenomenon. So that's kind of one of the things that I worry about is you have all these wars going on. We have Ukraine and Russia. The one in the Middle East seems to be spreading. And, you know, we have to worry about things spreading beyond where they are. And that's one of the concerns that I have is, do we have the capability of coming together as a world to stop some of these crises? And it's I'm not quite sure where we are when it comes to that.
Well, let's turn to your work, because you're a professor of psychiatry at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. That's where Daniel Mama teaches, learns, and spreads the knowledge. Do you see psychiatry as a way of healing the world? Are you in a healing art?
I am in the healing arts. I do feel like it's very important to focus on mental health in addition to physical health, whether that's through psychiatry or through psychotherapy or through social supports. But the mind is really important for healing, and we have to focus on that also, and it is often ignored.
What's your specialty in psychiatry?
Well, I'm a general psychiatrist. I tend to see mainly people who are teenagers or young adults who have severe mental illness, or they are at risk for having a severe mental illness like schizophrenia or psychosis.
Do you see any of that in our government? How about loaded question?
Maybe I would if I would have examined some people in my clinic.
But you safely choose not to issue diagnoses for people you haven't met.
Because some people just play to the cameras and you just really don't know what is real and what is not.
Sure. I asked you this before. I'm going to ask you again. What is your purpose in writing this book? It's not like you don't have enough work to do as a professor of psychiatry. Maybe it's just because, like your father, who seemed to work himself to the bone every day of his life, the aim high, shoot high, this. Why did you write As the Rivers Merge?
Well, I wrote it basically because I wanted my children to know who their grandparents were, right? So this was why I first started writing this book 12 years ago when my wife was pregnant with our first child. So that was really the initial reason to put pen to paper here, is I really wanted to bring the stories of my parents together. But as I started writing it, I started to also see things that other people could benefit from, right? I mean, I realized that my family, my relatives would be really happy to learn about these beautiful stories that I discovered. That kept pushing me, that kept allowing me to keep writing and not giving up. And then I realized also that there are a lot of themes that cross into current events that perhaps could inspire people, right? Whether it's wars and overcoming wars and overcoming trauma, or just overcoming challenges, cross-cultural difficulties, political tumult, right? And that was another inspiration to keep writing, is this is going to help someone out there, someone who may look at their life and feel like they have nothing to look forward to. They can never overcome this challenge that they have. So there are multiple reasons that kept pushing me in this journey.
Well, it's a wonderfully told story, spanning many continents, scanning many decades, so many different experiences. I think so many issues that we're facing in the U.S. right now, there's some key to understanding it better in this book. And so I appreciate the work that you did putting it together. Again, probably working yourself to the nub. I'm glad that you're as charismatic as your father was, and to carry that forward in the world and to keep aiming high in the same way that you do. And I thank you so much for joining me here today for Spirit in Action.
And thank you so much for inviting me.
Again, the book is As the Rivers Merge, A Story of Love, War, and Perseverance Across Continents by Daniel Mama. That's M-A-M-A-H. We'll have a link for the book and to Daniel on the NordenspiritRadio.org website. And we'll see you next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find Deep Roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.